Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 242, featuring Kobus Bothma, who is a director of applied research at KPF, Cohn-Pedersen Fox, which is a very well-renowned architecture firm, and he is based in London. He's a really cool guy. Kristen, you met him. When did you first meet him?
I met him at Total Chaos this past May.
Right.
Yeah. So nice.
Really nice guy, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Really cool. But we actually did not record this podcast in May at Total Chaos. We recorded it at SIGGRAPH.
Yeah.
So he came to SIGGRAPH. Did he talk for us at SIGGRAPH too?
Yes, he did.
Right?
Yeah. Talks. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Which was great, which was really cool. So what are some of the things that you liked about this episode?
Well, I didn't know that his first project that he worked on the Abu Dhabi airport.
Yeah.
And I did not know it was a mile long. So that was cool.
It's a very big airport.
Mm-hmm. And then also that KPF was one of the first testers of Lovina, and they said they're going to try their next big project with it. So
Really cool. Lovina is a big deal, and it's very early technology, and Kobus is the kind of person that's willing to try some very new tools. Really great stuff. For those of you who don't know what Lovina is, it is one of our renderers. We have many, but it is 100% focused on real-time ray tracing, and it is 100% ray traced. There's no rasterization that's being done. It's just all ray traced. And he talks a lot about the advantages of that technology and where it goes. But we also talk a lot about VR. We talk about BIM and about all the different things that are the struggles and technology that are going through basically in architecture today. So really cool guy to have on. Very interesting. So anyway, let's get through some announcements. What's going on in our events area and things like that?
All right. So again, you can find all this stuff at chaosgroup.com/events.
Mm-hmm.
And we just released the V-Ray for Cinema 4D is now compatible with Cinema 4D R21.
Right.
That happened yesterday.
So if you guys are V-Ray for Cinema 4D users, you will be able to get that update. So go check it out on our website as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And then a few more events. So we've announced this a few times. On September 22nd in Kiev, we'll have the CG event. And that's a Chaos Group sponsored celebration.
Nice.
And then in Berlin on September 23rd, it will be a Chaos meetup. So that will be a debut.
Right.
Of us being there.
Yeah. And I will be going to Malta basically in a week. And I'm very excited to do that. This is going to be for THU. I'll be recording a bunch of podcasts there. And it is from September 22nd to the 29th. So very excited to go to Malta and be part of THU again.
Mm-hmm. And then lastly, we are still promoting the Total Chaos 2020 call for speakers. So if anyone you know is interested, it's a long one. So go to chaosgroup.com/total-chaos/become-speaker. So we're looking for talented artists and developers who have a vision to share or a unique perspective on the newest developments in computer graphics.
Awesome. Yes, we would love to have you as a speaker. If you want to be a speaker or you know someone who would be a good speaker for Total Chaos, we'd love to know more about it. Great. And just lastly, where can people follow us?
Facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast.
Great. And if they want to give us ideas for guests or speakers, where can they reach out to us?
Just email us at labs@chaosgroup.com.
Great. Perfect. And just another last reminder, we always would love to know more about what you guys think about the podcast and review us. It's actually very helpful for us if you do it on Apple Podcasts itself. That's actually a really good place to get some reviews and if you want to write up something, that'd be great too. So just go to Apple Podcasts and look up CG Garage and leave us a review. All right, guys. Thank you so much. Hopefully you will enjoy this great podcast with Kobus Bothma from KPF.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So let's talk about how a young South African man
like me,
like yourself, was able to go from,
where were you living in South Africa?
In Cape Town.
In Cape Town.
Yeah.
Nice.
Actually, I grew up just outside Cape Town. So,
oh yeah.
Yeah. Sort of. When you leave my town, you're in the farms.
You really?
Yeah.
So. Okay. So when did you? What was your journey from Cape Town to London? How did that journey take place?
Well, I was involved with design very early in the 90s, more sort of industrial design. And then I joined a company in the mid-90s, an industrial design firm that was also a reseller of Bentley software. So with So with my use of that, I got involved with the architectural side of the software. And in the late 90s, I started my own company. Uh-huh. And through this, using Bentley software for sort of BIM models, generating BIM models and visualization, really marketing kind of stuff and so forth.
Right.
I went to the Bentley conferences.
And, oh, right. Okay.
I spoke to the Bentley conferences, and I think there were 3 or 4 years in a row that I was nominated for awards. I never won anything because I was too small. You know, I was like, right. I was up against like the Fosters and the KPFs and the NBBJs of the world. And
right.
We were a little 5-man outfit in Cape Town. And
right.
Even though they liked what we did, it wasn't a... you know, we didn't have the kind of marketing credential for them to make big stories.
Sure.
Yeah. And then that's where I actually met...
Well, what were you doing? I mean, what kind of stuff were you doing?
We were sort of in the 90s and 2000s, many of the architects didn't do 3D modeling.
Okay. Right?
So, and we were working on quite extensively with the developers. Uh-huh. So anything from tall buildings in Cape Town and Johannesburg to golf course estates and housing estates.
Right.
So we would take their drawings, generate models from it, mm-hmm. And then give them some feedback. Sometimes they liked it or didn't like it.
Sure.
And then generate stills and animations. And we also had an advertising company that would take that then into the whole marketing campaigns.
Right. Right.
And for efficiency's sake, because we were so small, we'd be using one of their BIM applications, which was really great. And the difference is, for us against the other big visualization firms, is that we were charging them to generate the model with everything.
Right.
So we didn't generate content for a view. We would generate a complete project. And then we charged them very little for photography. Sort of virtual photography of these things and animations and stuff. You know, it was mainly processing time and a bit of post-processing. And, you know, we did okay. We were doing some really cool things in those days. You know?
Yeah.
And,
well, BIM was pretty rare
at
that time, right?
Yeah. Well, my first intro to BIM was when I actually joined that design company in 95.
Uh-huh.
Bentley just bought or had a license agreement, or I can't remember how it was, with a company called Bricsworks. And I remember installing the rename of Bricsworks Triforma on a machine, I think it was for Stiffies,
mm-hmm.
you know, in 95, 96. And I kind of had a passion for that kind of stuff as well. And that's why I got involved in the software side, because I started doing pre-sale support.
Right.
You know, taking some of our clients' work and showing them how to generate BIM models in the sort of 90s.
Nice.
And I used it. We used it extensively and really pushed it until I kind of moved to the UK, and then things just upscaled. You
know? Right.
Just went in a different level. So.
So when did you move to the UK?
In 2008, about 3-4 months before the big bang, the big blow up of the world economy. So,
right.
Yeah. So which I survived, which is great. But I remember joining, and it was April, and in September, October, that's when all hell broke loose.
Yeah.
And we were, but I was fortunately, I was on a very big project at that point. The Abu Dhabi airport. And I was assigned to do all the custom and bespoke furniture and fixtures. So all the check-in desks, all the desks, all the binnacles and camera posts, and, you know, all bespoke interior stuff.
Sure.
That was kind of my package, but, I guess part of my background is that they also assigned me to manage the complete 3D data set,
right?
Which was huge. I mean, this is a building that's a mile across, and it's very complex.
Yeah,
it's very complex. Actually, you know, we did a rendering at the time, and we actually dropped a building on London, and our offices in Covent Garden, and the other end of the building was on the London Eye.
Wow,
it's insane. So then, you know, I worked on that intensely for 3 years. Managed the visualization set, managed the 3D data set.
This is
at
KPF, right?
This is at KPF, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And at the time as well, in 2009, KPF kind of, London had a split.
Right.
And KPF firm-wide regrouped itself a little bit and became a sort of a singular global firm instead of, you know, which is very different to what architectural practices do these days. They typically have a sort of an umbrella and then individual offices.
You know? Yes.
And we then became one big office, which is pretty cool. Pretty challenging, but pretty cool.
Okay.
I think till about 2011, I worked on the airport, and then I jumped for a year or two on other projects, some towers and stadiums and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then for another 3 years, I got back into the airport when I started construction.
Right.
We had this kind of computational team working on the airport, and 2009, the decision was made to break up these separate groups inside the office.
Okay.
So the visualization group disappeared in London, for example, and the computational group. Mm-hmm. And they try to move it to the users, to enable the users to do some of the
things. To do them themselves, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, the airport was done by really smart guys, and it's a really complex building.
Right.
And somebody had to take... So I myself and a small group became the lead on the sort of RFIs and requests from the contractor on how we're going to build this thing during the construction phase for the first 3 years.
Right.
So we were just doing reverse engineering of geometry and putting it out into little storyboards of, you know, we developed this thing as if you can't sketch it out on a piece of paper, then we should rethink how they're going to build it. and do these little storyboards of this is actually how you need to build this piece of geometry.
Okay.
But the beauty about it is that, as I said, we had really, really good people that had the understanding of complex geometry when they designed this building. So it was, you know, it looks very complex, which is something that I try and drive now through computational design. But the principles are quite simple.
Right.
You can have one sheet to do, you know, the set out of a 400 by 400 meter, 20,000 ton structural roof.
Right.
You know, which is quite insane.
So tell us a little bit about computational design, the way you say it.
Yeah. Well, in the aspect of how we use it in design, KPF has always been involved with it from early days.
Okay.
I don't want to say the late 80s, but definitely the 90s. And especially the late 90s and early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
We were quite instrumental with companies like Foster's and Arup and others, NBBJ and so forth, on how computational design would affect architecture.
Okay.
You know, it was kind of before my time. I followed it.
Mm-hmm.
The Bentley conferences had this Sunday architectural research days, which were incredible, you know.
And right.
That's where a lot of the talks happened worldwide during those conferences, and the big guys from MIT and everybody got around.
Right.
And discussed new methods and processes, and it was driven very much by generative components, which was the MicroStation. It wasn't node-based then, but their computational platform.
Okay.
I think it was originally came from object-oriented modeling, it was called, and then became generative components that Robert Ashe developed.
Okay.
And it did very well, and it was a kind of a small group worldwide that made a big impact on it. So we were one of the first companies to use computational design to determine planarity of facade components on towers. You know, you can't twist glass panels, you have a complex building, especially during the 2000s with these bubble architecture or complex architecture. You want to keep glass as flat as you can.
Right.
You can
get curved glass, but it's ridiculously expensive.
Well, that's the thing. And you know, the funny thing is in the 2000s, it was, you know, there were some wild architecture going on.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there were some wild things going out there. And it was really to prove the point.
Right.
And then I think after the sort of 2008...
Blobby architecture.
But then people kind of went, hold on, we need to build things that are cheaper, right? We can't go mad anymore. So, but that was quite cool because you know, my whole concept of complexity making simplicity or simplicity making complexity in a way is still valid today in the buildings we do, because we do, you know, I work with a principal that in London office that do complex buildings.
Sure.
But we drive the method to be able to fabricate this and make it within budget.
Right.
You know, so, and it's hard. It's not easy, but we don't do chewing gum. You know, we're trying to, I call it chewing gum. You know, there's other, I did a talk a little while ago, and I said I think it was one of these major designers, I can't remember who it was, who actually took a piece of snot and scanned it and made a vase out of it. And I said, he can do it because he is who he is. Okay, we can't do that, right? We build buildings, right? We need to be able to to understand geometry. And right. one of the big principles we teach now is basic architectural geometry, how right. to take a simple concept, a simple fabrication method or design method and
apply it to another room.
That looks complex, right. but it looks interesting at least, let's just say that.
Okay, you know, because so. there was definitely a moment where there was an architecture where people just crumple up a piece of paper and put
absolutely.
It on the table and
absolutely.
Say, make that.
Absolutely, and there's still a little bit of that, but you know, it's really hard, and it's especially hard because, you know, we work across the world, and
sure.
We're busy with a project now in Kuala Lumpur, and we're working with German facade engineers that mm-hmm. figured out how to do the facade panels.
Yeah.
But that's half the challenge.
Right.
The other challenge is, how can we get the locals to build that?
Yeah, of right. course.
We can build it in Germany, but we can't build it on site. You know,
right,
it's just
right.
we don't have the skills there. So
right.
You have to really, you know, go through the whole process of the underlying principle of geometry to who's the guy that's going to actually make it. You know,
right.
It's not the smart contractor or whatever. It's a guy in the backyard welding stuff.
Right.
You know, and literally with a hammer beating it.
Right.
In shape.
Yes.
You know? And you know, we are quite particular that our building should have a really good attention to detail and should be neat.
Right.
You know, that's one of our sort of signatures and what we've done. So
yes.
So you kind of have to understand that end process. And I learned that very much on the Abu Dhabi airport, you know.
Right.
At the beginning as well.
Right.
So,
right.
So we use computational tools heavily and we try and encourage and train our designers as well to use it and to understand the kind of power behind it or the method of design behind it.
Do you feel that now, you know, since we've gotten, you know, past some of the blobby architecture, just make something like that, you know,
yeah.
they come up with some shape and they're like, great, let's
yeah.
just do that. Do you feel now that since you've learned, since we've figured out how to use these tools to make things, make things that are complex or seemingly complex simply, mm. right? Do you feel that now that has, people have educated themselves on those tools and that has now influenced design in itself?
I think to a degree. I don't, and this is a very, very kind of important fact, I don't want software to depict design.
Right.
And I think to a degree it has happened in certain instances of slimming or trimming the design process based on cost and complexity and so forth.
Sure.
But I think it has definitely influenced design. And you got to be careful when you teach somebody new tools like Grasshopper and they start exploring it. And then you see it in the student stuff. You know,
And it's
beautiful, wonderful, and radical and amazing, but it's really podium scale.
But you can they all look the same after all.
Well, this is the thing, but this is what I'm saying, because they find these tools.
A fractal looks like a fractal.
They find these tools, I mean, you know, the whole Voronoi thing, you know, that's,
yeah.
we don't touch it, but touch it if you want to, and if you understand
we'll have
it.
Have a purpose.
Yeah, yeah. But this is why I come back to the thing of, you know, this is a cylinder and this is a slab, you know,
right.
This is a sphere and a torus and look at these shapes and understand how you can actually generate architecture.
Right.
In many cases, we kind of allow freedom.
Yes.
And then we redefine that sort of freedom of design and try to make it into some logical language.
Right.
And you find that we're pretty close in matching the free design mm-hmm. with a logical design. But the logical design, most cases, look better. Because an arc looks better than some random 1,000-point curve that is erratic, you know.
Okay.
And you kind of find that, funny enough, in buildings, the simplicity of form that's underlying really makes the building look so much better than just the chewing gum.
Right.
You know, but it's finding that form is the difficult part. You know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I've had this conversation with Greg Lynn, interestingly.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Sure.
And so he and I talk, and, you know, when I first encountered Greg Lynn's work was when I was in architecture school, so we're talking late 90s, right? Or
yeah.
like around 94, 95,
yeah,
actually.
Okay. Right.
You know, that was, you know, let's see what we can do with NURBS,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's, you know, since then, and like, you know, we've talked, he's like, yeah, the years of the happy accidents have gone away.
Yeah.
We're done with that.
Yeah, yeah.
We now things have purpose.
Purpose, exactly.
You
yeah.
know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
so they didn't necessarily have purpose. They're like, ooh, I like
yeah.
that shape, you know?
Yeah.
The
yeah.
chewing gum is gone. Okay,
yeah, yeah.
It's interesting.
No, which is, you know, one of the main guys on the airport that did the geometry said to me one day, there's this kind of three levels. There's parametric design, there's competitive design, and then
right.
there's generative design.
Right.
And I think the early days, it was accidental generative in a way.
Right.
Like you said, you didn't really know what you're going to get out there. And,
right.
Because it was so different, people threw the money at it, you know, and they
right.
built it.
Yeah.
But nowadays, you have to think about the whole process. It doesn't mean you're limited, for sure not. You know, we still do radical stuff like the Peterson Museum down the road here.
Yeah,
it's quite something different to what KPF normally would do.
Yeah,
but it is it's quite simple. The engineering side of that was quite great.
You know, it was interesting you mentioned that museum, because I was working at Gensler during that competition.
Oh, right, okay.
And Gensler was designing their version, and we lost the competition.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry.
It's fine. But that was years ago.
Yeah.
And so I remember that, and I was like, no, KPF went in, it's like, they've come up with a really cool design. And I was like, I was always curious, you know, because it took years between when that competition happened and when the construction actually took place. Years.
Yeah.
And so when it finally got built, it's like, oh, I can finally see the design and what it looks like.
Right.
And it is a great design, and I love that museum.
But it is a love-hate kind of design, I think. You know?
Is it?
I think there's a people that go, you know, and then there's people that go, it's awesome. But the, you know, there's always an underlying story behind why it happened and how it was done and so forth.
Right.
And actually a very good friend of mine worked on it, and it was done fairly simply in a way, you know, and then translated I think Zayner did the facade on it, and they really did a good job under designing and using sort of CATIA tools and advanced tools to generate the actual assembly structures,
yeah.
You know, and I was on site actually, I was at a SIGGRAPH here, I think it was 2014 or 2013, I'm not sure, and I actually went on site and had a look at it. But the coolest was seeing the Batmobiles and stuff underneath.
Yeah.
All the cars was in the basement, all in the basement, you know. And it's
a great museum.
Yeah.
If anyone's in LA and you have a chance, you know, you can go to LACMA, which is great, across the street.
But
then go to the Peterson.
The stuff inside this is unbelievable.
And a little secret, as you said, the basement. So there is a private tour that you can get at the Peterson, and it only costs like $20.
Wow, well, yeah.
And
yeah.
do that, because it'll just quadruple your experience.
Yeah, no, he's got some gems in there. It's unbelievable.
I think they have a gold-plated DeLorean.
Yeah. The coolest car I saw besides the Batmobile was the Rolls Royce, the one with the fins that like really
wasn't that from the Shah of Iran?
I think it was one of those. It's unbelievable. That's really cool. I have this kind of passion for cars, but unfortunately never spend money on cars, which is a good thing.
Yeah, it's a good thing. You don't get return on investment on cars.
No.
maybe anything.
Yeah, when you retire one day.
maybe by the time you get to the museum.
Yeah.
Okay, I did a little tangent on that, because I love that museum.
Yeah, great.
There's several things, obviously, are going on at this point. What was your role? So what were some things you were doing? I mean, computational design is some things you're doing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
What were some of the other things or specialties that you had gotten while you were at KPF?
So we probably since 2010 or 2011, after a breakup of specialist groups, we understand that there needs to be a drive towards technology and so forth. And it took a little while to understand, and I think it's probably because of the regression of technology during sort of from 2010 to where we are now.
Okay.
But probably about 6-7 years ago, we started forming subgroups again in sort of diffused manners that were taking on particular functions and so forth.
So you're going from enabling the users to creating subgroups again?
Yeah, but really as overview.
That's an overview. Okay.
Yeah. There's one particular group called KPF UI, which is called Urban Interface, that formed, and they had a direct relation with the client and how we were doing, in particular, master plan designs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very strong, and it's one of our sort of great USPs in terms of how we design.
Uh-huh.
But they now, you know, everything's kind of fluidly formed into an advanced technology branch that deals with everything from sort of global infrastructure, which is how we operate as one big firm.
Okay.
You know, how we use cloud applications and our hardware and software and so forth to the opposite end of it, which is applied research, which is where I'm sitting right now.
Okay.
And as we go sort of towards the middle, there's kind of these six bubbles. As we go sort of towards the middle, that's focusing towards the user and the client.
Interesting.
You know, so we're looking at these two outside spheres, looking at the big picture stuff and how we operate.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have digital practice, which is the guys that hold the hands of the designers. You know, so anything that kind of comes out from technology or software or hardware, they teach, enable, and support the designers. You're, you're kind of CAD BIM managers, kind of, in a way.
Give an example, if you can, of what, like, a situation.
Well, partly training, partly support. Mm-hmm. So we would, for example, find a new piece of software, like a couple of years back, you know, when Enscape came around. You know?
Got it, yeah.
And you know, we would go through a couple of things, do some proof of concept for it and so forth, and then hand it over to Digital Practice. And Digital Practice would then deploy it. They build the deployments. They train people on it, get people to understand how to use it. And, you know, that's then taken up. Some gets taken up by the users. Some don't get taken up by the users. Mm-hmm. And then the users become, that becomes part of their palette, their sort of method of design. You know, we launched a really intense training session about a year ago to train the users as well. Okay. So we have that in combination with actually enabling teams with competent people, mm-hmm. To make sure that the teams get trained and use Grasshopper tools and analysis tools, daylight analysis tools, and mm-hmm. visualization tools at different levels, and even simple CAD and BIM functions.
Got it.
On the actual team. So the Digital Practice guys are really the bubble around our designers. They really take care of the designers.
Nice.
And then we have our environmental performance guys who deal with sustainability. Absolutely. A big topic. It's always been a big topic. We've got a great guy that joined our New York office who's kind of leading that practice.
The lead skies, basically,
right? Yeah. Well, but we go deeper to that. You know, we're trying to really be smart about how we approach this, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of, there used to be a lot of, well, here's the design, it's great. Oh, we need a page at the end that tells us what we're doing with solar radiation, you know?
Right.
And it kind of like defeats the object. And,
sure.
And, you know, my cousin works for the UN. On sustainability, and I get numbers from her, and it's scary. You know, I put this in front of our principals, and they go, "Ooh, okay." And I said, "Well, guys, we are responsible for this. Mm. We're going to make a change, and we are, which is great. You know, it's a really hot topic at the moment. And,
absolutely.
And you know, the
very hot topic.
Very much. But the concept of, you know, how can we change that is not that easy. Because we're dealing with clients and people that want to build the way they build. But
but
even simple things are saying, can we propose a local material versus an imported material?
You know,
even if the local material is more cheap, but we need to give those options. We need to understand,
you know,
because it is we are affecting the world. You know,
oh, absolutely. I remember I was taking in an environment class in college, and we're talking like 1991 or something. And one of the things that came up was like, do you really need strawberries in January?
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
People
expect it 12 months out of the year. And that's insane what that does to the environment.
Funny enough you mentioned that. I did in the mid-90s, I did a collapsible fruit pallet design.
Okay.
You know, because trucks drive with fruit to location A, and they come back with a truck full of empty pallets.
Right.
So we were designing this pallet, could take apart, and you could stack 4 trucks with pallets in 1 truck.
Right.
But, you know, what I saw there is the actual fruit market. You know, we have a big fruit industry in Cape Town.
Of course, I'm sure.
And exported, I mean, many of the fruit we eat in the UK is from South Africa. But they have these huge warehouses running 24/7, 365 days a year, keeping apples fresh for consumption out of apples a season. You know?
Right.
And you're kind of like, trying to buy what's, you know, trying to find what's growing in your garden, trying to eat that.
I know. Seasonal fruit, it used to be a thing.
But sustainability is a big thing. And then we have the UI team, which deals with urban analytics. And we're slowly creeping in, and we've been involved with this for quite a while, but it's kind of forming its own right now, is our data science team.
Data science?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, data science. So not just from processing the numbers and data inside our office, like how do people use software, how do people use spaces, you know, what are the hours on certain teams, how are teams staffed, and so forth.
Okay, so this is more internal research.
Yeah. But also that's very much branching out now on how machine learning is going to affect us.
You know? Really
much. And we have, you know, one of my colleagues in New York, who's really smart and really on top of this, and mm-hmm. kind of leads that effort.
Sure.
You know, we all semi-participate, and you know, these spheres are not separate. They're all as one big sphere, you know.
Sure.
On on how machine learning is going to affect the way we design in the future, you know?
Well, you know, I was at SIGGRAPH. I went to a bunch of talks. I don't think there was a single one that did not use machine learning.
Yeah.
Every single one,
you know? Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's a good thing you mentioned SIGGRAPH, because that's one of the reasons we come here. You know,
right.
We as a practice, I mean, we're not a small practice. We're not the largest, but we're not a small practice.
Right.
And we have problems. You know, we have problems with technology. We have problems with data. We have problems with security, licensing, and so forth. But we have nothing against the big studios that come here. You know, so we can just learn from how these guys are looking at it and solving issues. You know,
sure.
The mere fact I was at the Unreal Talk user group, and the mere fact that the producers can now go into VR and co-produce virtually was never before. It was never they never had the tools before to do that.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that we are looking very strongly. You know, I get challenged a lot about the future of architecture.
Sure.
You know, I was on a panel the other day, and it was one of those things where I know the question was going to come, but but the questions were laid out that it was going to be question number 6 or 7. So we could warm up to the process.
Okay, sure.
And then the second question that was fired at me from the guys were like, so Kubis, you're an architect. You know, we tell you that you're not going to be needed in the future. What's your comment on that? I'm going, hold on. I thought we were going to get to that later, you know. But let's talk about that.
Why?
Yeah.
I think that's a silly question.
It is a very silly question. It's a very, very silly question.
That's like saying, oh, that's all right. I can make a Rembrandt in deep learning, so I don't need artists anymore.
No, you know, it is a very, very silly question. I think the effect of machine learning is going to take away that... You know, I have this concept of architecture being the designer that sketch and do things and cut foam and make things and have the real passion and vision for what the building should be and the space should be.
Right.
And then you have the technical draftsperson that draws that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The architect doesn't have to waste their time, unless they need to draw to actually define a space, doing production work. They do design work. They're emotional. They are intelligent and have vision about how things should happen.
Sure.
And then you have the contractor that picks up the drawing that built it.
Right.
Right. And that is like long years ago. And I think it's going to return in a matter, but with technology infused. Mm-hmm. So I think the designers are really going to step away from technology. They're going to step away from keyboards and mouse and having to, you know, like in my talk, having to click and wait for a render and, you know, kind of draw 2D outlines to get areas and, you know, draw lines and draw things. They're going to have tools to enable them to design.
Right.
Like really design. And of course there are those guys that are going to be involved with technology, but for many architects they're going to be designers.
Right.
But they're going to have the tools that are intuitive for them to understand design. And then a lot of the stuff that's in books and repetitive and sort of can be computed will happen in the background.
Right.
You know. But with the beauty then that's kind of the not the technical draftsperson anymore, but that's the computer scientist, technologist that make that happen.
Okay.
You know, that's kind of like behind the walls, behind the scenes. And then that data is also translated to fabrication and construction. So I really think that's the concept of augmenting the designer, that's really where it's sitting at.
So you really feel that the tools that are coming from machine learning right now are going to enable a lot of creativity to the
absolutely.
Person. So this removes labor as well.
Well, you know, in a way, it also creates labor, right? Because those tools don't happen by themselves.
Sure.
And they would be custom built and custom trained and so forth.
Right.
So there's people that need to be able to do that.
You know? Right. So new skill sets.
Absolutely, new skill sets. And if you look at one of the futures, you know, how do you future-proof yourself? Is the top line is they adapt new skills.
Right.
Your job may not be valid or as valid in the future, so you're going to have to reinvent yourself sometimes.
Right.
So, but the beauty about this, and this is we're researching a couple of papers right now, and we are starting to look at building systems like that, is not have a machine learning process from start to end.
Mm-hmm.
Use the machine where you want to use it in the process, and then get the designer to continue again. Let it solve some issues for you.
Right.
And then continue designing, and then take the continued or progressed design that the designer did,
sure.
and put it back into machine learning, and then you do the next function,
okay.
and then take the break again, you know, and get out what you need to. So So, and I think there's a lot of time spent on you know things like vertical transportation and, mm-hmm. and things like that could be semi-automated or at least nudged by the designer, but it knows that it comes up with solutions,
right,
you know, and not 5,000 solutions. Three solutions.
Okay.
You know, right now there's a very much drive towards brute force processing and then picking the best options out of it. You know?
Right.
This will be more intuitive. It'll be more trained, I think.
Right. Well, you train it on the more you train it. So that's the thing, right? You have to train a lot of data to get this information. Yeah. So what are you going to train it on?
So that's another big challenge.
Yeah.
So there's two sides I see to it. I mean, the most effective way to do it is actually to define what you want to do.
Sure.
Or what you want to go train the model on.
Right.
And then do projects. Do a project for that. We're doing it right now. We're creating pseudo projects.
Okay.
And we're creating a project with parameters, and we do a generative model on it, mm-hmm. and we would have 10,000 or 40,000 or whatever outcomes. Mm-hmm. But they're controlled and conditioned by how we want to train the machine.
Okay.
There's no way we can take our 30, 40 years of drawings and put that in a machine learning algorithm to train how a lift course should be designed.
Okay.
It's a bigger job just to figure out where the lift is on the page than to actually train the machine.
Sure.
So we would go and do 50 types of towers and do 500 lift options on each mm-hmm. with permutations of it, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. And then train a machine on what is good and bad.
Okay.
And that's the one way of doing it. And that's how some of the practices do it as well. And some of the engineering firms as well are starting to do that because they understand that structural design is limited because it's all numbers, right?
Right.
It's all calculations and numbers. And that's where the machine's going to take over. But the second part of it, I think, which is going to be the interesting part, is that you as a designer and me as a designer is going to take on these models and we're going to do a sort of reinforcement training while we design.
Right.
So the machine will start predicting how you like to design versus how I like to design. So we're going to have our semi-custom design assistants as such. And I think that might be a tricky one, but it might be a very interesting field to get into. Mm-hmm. You have your kind of language and brand and effective. And there's no way that you can't stop that and change it and, dream at night and wake up in the morning and go, I need to do that. This is what I think we really should do. And then change the model slightly, and change the effect, some sketching and and so forth. So I think that might be the interesting thing because these virtual assistants are really popping up and that you have a custom design assistant.
Yeah.
It's an interesting concept.
Did you see Scott Edenstock at Total Chaos in Sofia? Where he was doing the digital human
stuff. I actually met Scott in London.
I went
to his exhibition. He's actually went Friday night. We have every end of month in London, we have payday drinks.
Uh-huh.
We kind of get the office together, have a couple of snacks and drinks, and we do some talk or some something. And we actually got him to come and do a talk on us on his artwork. And
perfect.
I find it fascinating.
Yes.
I find it really fascinating. And what's not just fascinating is not just his 2D paintings and his ability to do these really huge pixel-based paintings, but how we can start doing 3D geometry on it.
Right.
And, how we can actually
extract 3D printing.
I mean, I don't know if you saw the exhibition, but there were a couple of things at the exhibition that he didn't have resolved by the time of Sofia.
Right.
And these really beautiful bronze casts that, and they're wonderful.
Yeah.
Like amazing, and he's so out there and just so blasé about it. He just has this passion to do it and he's, it's like, look what I'm doing, and look at this cool, and I had a battle with this, but it worked, and it's...
Yeah.
It's really cool. It's really, really interesting, so...
Scott's really interesting. I thought it's like, what you're describing is basically as creating a tool that sort of helps you get to where you want to be.
Yeah.
Is really, that's what he does.
Yeah. Exactly. In essence, he is an artist, and he has a...
Oh, he is an artist.
He has a tool that like a paintbrush.
Yeah,
but it's the paintbrush that has the little nooks and crannies that he wants.
Right.
And the bristles are a bit odd, but he knows and he uses that to paint.
He was reluctant to call it a paintbrush.
Yeah, okay.
But in a sense,
very clever paintbrush.
But it is kind of like a paintbrush.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating what he's doing and that kind of work. And it's like this is exactly the kind of stuff that you're doing as well.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking. One of my peers, I was talking with him yesterday about the Gauguin. Training model, where you kind of do the landscapes and stuff like that. And I wonder if that's an easy thing to do with buildings. Okay, well, you just have to train it with building data, right?
Yeah.
But and then you can kind of. But again, is it what you want? Specifically. And when we get into specifics, that's where it gets a bit more advanced. You can do the quick collages and paints and so forth. But the idea of an augmented, and augmentation is not something that's. It's just going to be in our industry, We start talking about neural links and all these kind of things, which is scary, but it's happening. I mean, it really is happening, And you start reading your mind. I mean, what was it 2 years ago where we had neural VR here at Sigurov?
Yeah.
And they could control VR functions through just thinking about it.
Right.
It's kind of freaky, but it's people are researching it, and it's just a matter of time before it pops up.
Yeah.
It's, not sure I want to plug in yet, but
yeah, it's interesting. It's for sure, for sure. Okay, well, speaking of VR, I think I met you the first time was years ago, and when VR was just starting to happen, yeah. And you were starting to look at some VR stuff. Yeah. So, tell us how KPF is actually. Sort of done, yeah. Worked on the VR world.
So VR, I think my first kind of entry and what I refer to as static VR was in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yep.
There was this little app. We could render out 360s from Bentley MicroStation. And okay. There was an app called Traveler, and you could open up, you did this little script, and then you could open it up and have this, you know, but it was on-screen kind of panoramics, and you can build these little tools.
Right.
And to this day, we use static VR extensively through different mediums now, of
right.
course, you know, and you could decide if you want a headset or not a headset and
right.
these kind of things. And it's really great because it has real great render quality, and it's independent of polycount.
Right. right.
But it is static. So I think in KPF, our first proper dip into VR was in 2013. And it wasn't a pretty small project. It was that Abu Dhabi airport.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the main reasons was the client was challenging us and saying, well, you know, we need to be able to see three wayfind totems.
Okay.
Wherever you are, that's the rule. And wayfinding is really important on an airport.
Right.
And if you stand at any point and you want to go to a gate, you need to be able to see three totems, and we don't believe we can see it.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, fine, let's build a VR model.
Right.
You know, a real-time model. And it was hard. I mean, we were running, I think, at a push at 15 frames a second. You know,
right.
It was horrible, but it proved the point. It sold the point. We built this huge interior space without all the furniture because we couldn't load it.
Mm-hmm.
And we showed the client. And from there, we kind of progressed and started building it up. And then HoloLens happened.
Right.
Which is a really interesting concept because we didn't expect it to have that effect. And we got HoloLens through our New York office, so we got it quite early in London.
Mm-hmm.
And I built a model for one of the projects, for one of our principals, and he went, can we take this to the client? I said, sure, take it with.
You know? Sure.
Actually, for almost about 2 years, that semi-dominated a lot of our virtual kind of work.
Right.
And we built models 1-to-1, 1-to-100, 1-to-1,000. You know, we built master plans the size of this room where you could walk through. You know, we put on a tower at 1-to-10, that's 30 meters tall, so it's a 300-meter tower for the client. And we got a HoloLens in Hong Kong, and we have them in New York, and I would build and deploy there.
Right.
I probably build one or two models a month. You know, and not much functionality. You know, some scaling and some switching of options and so forth. And it was really just as a supplement to the design meetings. But in many cases, it became a really valuable tool where we would be challenged by the City of London, for example, on facade depths.
Mm-hmm.
And we would build a HoloLens model and put it on 1-to-1, and they would actually look at it and go, "Okay, we get it. We understand it. Go ahead doing it." You know.
Sure.
There was a case where we were doing a project for quite a big client in London, and we did the visual mock-up, and there were corner details on the interior lobby that they didn't like. And
right.
the contractor said, I've done my job, I'm not changing it. So we built a virtual version of it, and we placed it right next to the actual version of it. And the client said, go ahead, we approve.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so it became a real valuable tool for us in terms of design communication. So VR took a little backstep then, but then of course it sort of the last year and a half it got really pushed up again in demand, you know, from clients and so forth. I still think many of our clients have issues with headsets.
Yeah,
you know, I did a pre-planning application meeting 3-4 weeks ago, and we had designers there, we had the City of London there, and everything, and I was the only guy with a headset on. You know, nobody else wanted to put the headset on.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of like, gosh, just look at it. But the beauty about that was it was all about public realm, and it proved the point because they said, can you look up? Because it's quite a tall building.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking up. I said, no, can you look up higher? And I said, no, I can't. I'm going to break my neck if I do it,
right.
Which proves the point. We're not going to look up like that when we walk around.
Right.
So we're using VR extensively, but VR, you know, of course, also expanded to real-time screen and so forth. And
right.
We are designing the new Changi airport model right now,
okay.
The airport project. And the client's very tech-savvy, and VR is a deliverable. We have a VR execution plan, like we have a building execution plan, like a building execution plan, and they have a cave. And at all the main meetings, they go into the cave and they walk through our current design to understand the space, which is perfect for that type of application. You know?
Right.
And I think I think headsets are going to go still a long way, but I think those kind of collaborative spaces where people don't have to put headsets on necessarily is where we find more and more people sort of gathering towards, you know, the kind of domes and the caves and stuff
right.
like that. They need a physical presence, but...
But do you think that, you know, like a HoloLens is, it allows you to see out, so it's not as intrusive as a VR headset, but it's just putting something on your head, right?
We have yet to come across a client at any level that would not put a HoloLens on. They would put a HoloLens on.
Really?
Yeah, just about everybody we've dealt with, you know, from this side of the world all the way through to Seoul.
Right.
But HMDs, you know, even our static VRs, you know, they take a Google Cardboard, they put it up, they take it like this and they put it down. And be like, no, you need to look around. You know, you need to turn around and go to some other point. And they don't like covering their faces, which is an odd thing. But saying that, you know, the young people, which we're kind of encouraging in the office, they will spend hours inside VR. And they're the future designers, right? They're the future people doing things. And we've been working quite a bit on how a holodeck would work, for example.
I'm sure there was a lot of people that refused to get into a horseless carriage, right?
That's true. I was one of the last guys to get a smartphone, but I did it.
I'm
joking.
But
no, I think VR, you know, when we break that barrier in terms of proper collaborative VR, you know, we're talking about flying a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were doing quite a bit of tests last year on NVIDIA's holodeck.
Mm-hmm.
And having people from multiple offices join in and see how,
yeah.
you know, and besides if we could replace the robotic person inside that space with a digital human, which is becoming possible very soon.
Yeah.
So I could see you as Chris in a virtual space,
you know,
and I could look at you and understand the space. Then it's going to open up what I refer to as, you know, we have 9 offices across the world, but I refer to as our 10th office.
Right.
You know, which is a virtual space.
Right.
A virtual meeting room that we can customize depending on how we want to meet and what we want to meet. And I really hope that comes through, because the time wasted on airplanes and airports and getting to someone to meet face-to-face, and at the point face-to-face is going to be okay in virtual space. You know?
Yeah. And airplanes are not great for the environment either.
They're not great at all. You know, I mean,
jet lag sucks.
I did a presentation meeting in Vienna a little while ago, and I calculated that my traveling time from door to door was 12 hours.
Right.
And I'm like, it's for a 20-minute presentation. It's insane. It is insane.
Yeah.
You know? So HoloDeck is a couple of things, and we work with a couple of companies where you start getting sort of virtual. People, you know, and you can see it with the Magic Leaps as well and so forth of the world.
Okay.
I know Microsoft is working on a couple of things. And it is this mixed reality, augmented reality platform is actually, I think, is the one that's going to take commercial or get commercial access the easiest.
Yes. Yeah,
very much.
Indeed.
Very, very much. So, yeah.
That's good. Well, I do want to talk a little bit, or as much as we can, about some of your experience recently with rendering. Obviously, rendering has changed a lot.
Absolutely.
You were one of our earliest testers or people that we had given Lavina to and figure out what to do with that thing. So I'd love to hear your experience about that and your thoughts, because obviously you not only it's like, this is cool, but you think about the implications of what that tool is going to do across the board. So what are some of your experiences when you're looking at how rendering's changed recently?
I gave a talk yesterday and... I was challenged by who must have been an architect about, you know, the other real-time applications and you know, he was asking about Inkscapes of the world.
And
Lumions and these kind of things and so forth. And I think it comes back to the point of, you know, what do you want to do? What is the intent of the designer, you know, and at what level do you want to take it to the next level? You know?
Sure.
So do we want to quickly just click a button, you know, and have one pipeline out to get an image? Mm-hmm. Or do we want to look at a bigger sort of holistic approach to a tool that can do multifunctions.
Sure.
And you know, the guys at Chaos are smart. I think they see right through all this. You know,
right.
they see the long term effect of it, and that's why I'm so supportive of them as well. But Lavina is interesting because it is still one of the pure 100% real time ray traced applications.
Right.
In development, right? Everybody else, you could kind of tweak it a little bit, switch it on and off.
It's a effect.
Yeah.
It's not pure ray tracing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But the beauty that we've been testing, the big thing that we've been testing now is that if we follow a sort of V-Ray pipeline as such, that you can decide what you want to do. We talk about these real-time engines, and many of them it is real time and it's a 2-minute animation that you set up and it's all great and there's entourage and post effects. Mm-hmm. But when you click the record button, it actually takes 4 hours to record. And you that defeats the real time aspect of it, right? You want to be able to capture real time.
Right.
Like you do in Unreals or Lavina or stuff like that, So on Lavina itself, the first initial test that we did, of course, was let's see how much we can throw at it. Let's see how much we can do at it. And this is the case I showed, and that's an old case already. Where we took a complex project of ours, mm-hmm. and we had a big park next door, and we populated the park with flowers and grass. There was no maps. It was just 3D geometry.
Just tons of geometry.
Yeah. We were looking, at shared instances in terms of polycounts was in the region of 10, 15 billion,
Right.
That was running on a RTX 6000. But we immediately saw the kind of implication of what do you want to do with your scene that's in Max or in Rhino?
Right.
It is so simple just to go, let's look at it in real time. Let's discuss it and open it up, it is early days for Lavina. It is early days for this whole real-time approach or the real-time ray traced approach and so forth. But just the ability to tweak aspects and move things around and now have multi-scene support and things like that is going to have an effect on how I think we design. And ideally, it's probably going to be a case of multi-people working like we do, might even across multi-offices or multi-users in a project. Write out what you've done as a VR scene. Let's go to the boardroom and throw them together and see where we are. And it's not the notion of we need to hit 60 or 90 frames a second. If it takes 2 seconds to update, it's okay.
Right.
It's good enough because we're looking at design and we're looking at it on screen. We're not going to have any motion effect or stuff like that.
Right.
But the ability to do it as accurate as possible. I've always driven visualization, trying to be as accurate to human and not simulated as possible.
Right.
It will have an effect, and you see that when you start switching on the sort of real time or RTX on and off and so forth. Mm-hmm. Sometimes RTX on doesn't look as good, mm-hmm. but it looks in terms of visual, but it looks natural. It looks acceptable, more acceptable than the kind of tweaked and glossy and over reflected in over sort of GI'd raster image, as such. So Lavina's feature, I'm really really close in following that, and I speak to the Chaos guys regularly, and I asked them yesterday, how regularly do you updates, because I want to keep on updating and get your new features and so forth.
Sure.
Is it kind of weekly that I need to get it posted? They go, no, we do about 3 a day, and some three days. So I said, well, I'll mail you if I need one.
Right, it's in the early development, so constantly being, I've had the exact same situation. I get like 3 different builds in a day, each adding like a major change.
So we're looking at it, and we're looking at it for our large geometries. We're talking about this.
You made a point specifically that just so people know, if you're in a rasterized situation and you have a certain amount of polygons and you add a whole bunch more, your performance drops drastically.
Exactly.
And anyone knows this if they're like in Max or Maya or whatever, and then they have certain geometry and you're just spinning around in OpenGL, it looks good. And then if you throw a crap load of geometry, you're down to like 1 frame every 2 seconds, right?
Exactly.
But in Lavina, it doesn't make much difference. The more geometry you have, you're like,
Well, that's the thing with people. I see this the kind of birth of real-time ray tracing in a way as a real clean cut in the CG industry. And rasterization, everything else is going to continue. Mm-hmm. It's not going to go away. But and this is also why I think software companies are still busy developing and grappling with the concept of how to really approach the best ways.
Right.
And that's why we have so many white papers being presented here on methods of how to affect real-time ray tracing or to optimize real-time ray tracing to the best. Because the hardware can do so much, but the software has to do a lot of the lifting as well. But this kind of clean break of where we are starting from about a year ago or so forth, with real-time ray tracing is a real big deal. And exactly for that thing, we spend... When I talk about building HoloLens models, we spend most of the time optimizing the model. getting the numbers down on the polys. And with VR headsets and so forth, we do the same thing. You have to trim the thing down to be able to perform because it has to perform.
Right.
It can only do this. It can't do more, you know?
Yep.
And that's where the applications of Levina is critical. Whatever you have here, designer, write me the scene, and we load it. It's done. It's finished. There's no thinking about it. You know,
it just
happens. You know, and like you said, I mean, you know, we do big buildings, and I'm challenging. One of our big challenges coming up now is to see where this Unreal model we're building for real time for this airport.
Right.
What would the effect be if we throw it in Levina as a visualization tool? You know?
Right.
And we're gonna start working on that soon and start benchmarking. I said to the Chaos guys yesterday, you know, I tried to break something and then pull back one step because then I know how far the software can go.
Right.
And I like making things run full speed. I like making it process.
You know? Sure. But the thing is, it keeps changing. You know, as it keeps going, as you said,
which is really great today.
Okay, so there's another thing that was interesting. And I was talking to Phil about it. You know, as people start using the software and start thinking about it, because last year it was literally out of the womb, right?
Yeah. But very
fresh baby.
Yeah, very fresh.
Right? And so now it's a year old.
Got your stack of nappies, right?
Yeah. Now it's a year old, so it's still, and you know, we're just starting to get it into the hands of people to try things. And as we're doing that, and as we start to see how people think about what they're doing, and it's not just for, you know, it's not just for games or anything else, because everyone thinks, it's the problem I had with VR. Like, VR is going to change movie making. No, it's not. It's going to change architecture, but it's not going to change movie making, right? And then they'll say, like, real-time ray tracing is going to change video games. Like, yes, but it's also going to do a lot of other things.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And so one of the things I talked about with Phil was interesting, because as he was starting to think about it, he was saying, you know, there's a lot of interesting things you can do with ray tracing that is not just about rendering. I was like, well, what do you mean? He says, for example, you know, have you ever had like a massive scene in Maya or Max where there's a millions of objects or something, right?
Yeah.
And you do a selection window to pick a bunch of them, and sometimes you have to wait like, you know, 10 minutes get the selection.
Yeah.
With ray tracing, it's just firing all the rays. You'll get that selection instantly.
Exactly. which is a really, really cool concept, because it's, you know, this is the stuff I love about technology. And this is kind of a... you know, I'm not a programmer or anything like that. You know?
Right.
You know, I use the tools, but I try and find the unique applications of it. And I think what you're doing there is hitting the nail on the head. You know, you know, one of the earlier concepts, of course, that came out of it is sound and stuff like that. You know?
Sure.
So you can semi-automatically build sound into your which makes a big effect on your experience and how things are perceived and so forth.
Yes.
But just the mere fact of the concept behind real-time ray tracing, or all ray tracing is such,
right?
You know, where are the other spin-offs of it? You know, and like you said, no, that selection thing, I mean, that's something I didn't think of.
Did you hear about using ray tracing to get a better simulation of sound?
Yeah, I've heard about that.
So you're in a room, you bounce the sound around with very sparse ray tracing data, almost for free, and you get a way better acoustics.
No. And the nice thing about this is, you know, again, we need to sometimes convince our clients.
Is this lobby going to sound good?
Exactly.
Right.
You know, do we need to have... But then, of course, it does come back to the question of, we need to make sure our materials are correct, right?
Right.
To be able to react to the sound, like we do with light. But in light, you can still fake it a bit. You know,
yep.
The sound, you got to be... But that's also being taken care of, so that's also good. But yeah, absolutely, that whole other side of the technology, you know, is great. I'd love to see what comes out of it. You know, I always look at the... Well, this is meant for A, but hey, guys, we can use it for B as well.
Because, the other thing that he mentioned is another side effect, and I'm sure there's going to be so many more, right? This is just off the top of the head.
Yeah.
It's like, it's ray tracing is brilliant for snapping two things together, because it knows exactly where it is in space, right? Because it just snaps that ray and boom. So you can pick up, you know, a piece of geometry and snap it to the other. You know, you don't have to check to see if it's going through the floor. It's there. Yeah. It's perfect.
And that'll be pretty cool. You know, we work a lot, and the designers work very late nights. You know,
right.
All we can say is we get models often that we need to analyze, and things aren't planar always, you know. You need to. So absolutely. I mean, I don't even want to start thinking about where the application is of this kind of tool. But I really think that there is this kind of before ray trace and after ray trace, and the tool. I mean, it kind of seemed evolved before, but the tool is going to be there for the taking for developers, and it needs people to be creative about it. I think.
Well, ray tracing is going to be like a common word.
Yeah.
That's proper vernacular and stuff.
Yeah.
Which I think is very interesting as well. Let me ask you something else. What sure. the because a lot of one a lot of stuff that I've actually been researching is not related to architecture, but because of the kind of brain that you have, I think I'm curious to see what your thoughts are. There's a lot of talks going on right now in terms about USD, which is the and the Hydra as well.
Yeah.
Have you seen any of those? And do you think that those types of tool sets are going to be an interesting
like
part?
Kind of USD, the kind of file formats and
File format. Yeah. Because I know that architecture has a huge issue with
collaboration
between different applications, I was wondering if USD is going to be part of that solution.
Yeah, it's an interesting, very interesting question. I don't know. Again, this is why I'm here. This is why I'm in LA at Seagraph.
Yep.
Because we look at one of the Marvel movies or the Jungle Books and Lion Kings and so forth.
Sure.
And it's perfect pixels on screen, right?
Right.
And there is a host of people from various industries with various software that made those pixels.
Right.
And they all came together.
Right.
Right. And they are solving it, and they have solved many of those issues. Mm-hmm. We haven't.
Right.
And we can only learn from that. And I think that the main issue with it, which we kind of have, and this is not against or for anything, but that the kind of process of architecture has been driven by very limited applications.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, in some cases, singular applications, which I don't want to mention, I'm sure you're aware of.
Sure.
And it has restricted the flow of data amongst applications. And to this day, I don't understand why everybody builds tools and there are multiple tools to try and solve certain collaborative issues, and it shouldn't be there anymore.
Right.
People like the McNeil guys are starting to breach that, but you can only receive what you can receive in terms of its geometry when you talk about stuff like Rhino Insight and so forth, sort of headless rhinos and stuff like that. But I think there's a growth in a sort of more neutral open platform. Now, not USD yet. Mm-hmm. So a little while ago, when applications like Flux was around, everything was written to a neutral database in the cloud, and it made a lot of sense.
Right.
Because now you have this person's model from application A, this person's data from application B, this person's from application C, written to a neutral database, nicely tagged, and you could write it onto any one of the applications that you wanted to.
Right.
So it was a real great kind of effort. Mm-hmm. They closed down. They went away, and a lot of people are still crying to this day. There's other people that are trying to come up with that. But I think this approach of a neutral format is really needed, really needed. USD will probably not solve the design side of it, the application side of it. It'll probably solve the output, which is very important, which is the visual side of it, making the visual communication better.
Right. It's a model.
But it is
an open source.
This is the thing. We talk about USD in the sort of CG industry as, we understand what it can do and how it can be applied.
Sure.
If you say that to an engineer or an architect, they're going to go, use what?
Right.
You're talking about use dollars or what are you talking about USD? Right. They're going to talk about, they might understand FBX, but they're probably going to be talking about FC and stuff.
Okay, here's the irony, right? So FBX is a file format that was developed for motion capture.
Absolutely.
And so
they might. If
an architect can understand FBX, that's fine. I mean, means universal scene description, but it could mean you can do UDD, design description, or whatever it is.
Yeah. But the mere fact that FBX is used only on the Vista side. It's never used to take an ARCHICAD model to Revit.
Right.
You wouldn't really typically use FBX for that. You'll do it when you start getting.
What do you use?
Well, IFC is even floating, but IFC is not even what we do, the best method we do at the moment is to actually deconstruct the model to data.
Right.
And then use the data to rebuild it in the other application.
And
in many cases that's because geometry across people don't read geometry. They like to generate their own geometry.
Right. Now, especially if it's BIM related, right?
Exactly. Especially if it's BIM related.
You made a box, but you don't know what that box is, and BIM needs to know what that box is, right?
Yeah. Right. And I mean, my box could be six B-spline surfaces, but you're running on a parasolids engine, and it needs to translate surfaces to parasolids.
Right.
And it needs to bridge that kind of gap, or ACES, whatever the case is.
Right.
But to get back to USD, I'm pretty excited about it, and there's some big drivers behind it. There's some big people that are really believing in it, and as you mentioned earlier, if it's a sort of a neutral database to describe geometry and the related data around the geometry, materials, or whatever the data is, I really hope it's up there for the taking to let people develop that to design models and stuff like that.
Right.
You know? I mean, you know, the problems we have is that everything we're trying to work on in architecture, I mean, even IFC, it gets reinvented every now and then, and it comes and goes and comes and goes in different flavors. But
right.
But guys, let's just put it out on the table as data.
Right.
You know, as something that can be described and understood and read by everybody, and all you have to do is a little bit of programming on your side to receive it.
Right.
Right. Or to be able to write it. And I spoke to the NVIDIA guys a few weeks ago. I had a dinner with them, and I said to them, look, you know, are you guys looking at Rhino and Grasshopper? And they go, no, because their premise on what they're developing is very much based on USD.
Right.
And I said, well, you guys have to. You have to speak to these companies. And do you talk to these guys and these guys? And they go, we didn't know they existed. Well, they're big engineering software and architectural software applications.
Right.
So if you want to have something that is centralized, you know, you're going to have to include the players.
Right.
And they're definitely doing that. You know, they're very much, and I think I'm not the only one voicing that, you know.
That's good.
And I think the more we get these guys from the I wouldn't even call it a DCC application because you know it's not quite like the Maxes, but the Rhinos and the Revits and the Archicads and the Katias of this world to understand USD and to buy into it. The more we're going to get traction for it, and I think that's just a good thing.
Well, the other thing is why not, since it is an open source format, right? Yeah. I know it starts with the intention of being more used in the visual effects world, yeah. etc. But since it is an open source format, why not contribute back to it and make a point? Because if it can hold data of what the material is of this scene, and if it can hold data of you know what is the whatever the scene, it can also hold data of what is its design intent or whatever.
And who's the fabricator or whatever, who's this provider and so. Yeah. No, I agree with you 100%. And you know that's why I will be you know because we of course very interested in centralized data.
Right,
like I mentioned earlier, you know, centralized data formats, and I will be from my side, you know, definitely be voicing my interest in it with our software vendors, you know, trying to get those links happening and connect the two of them. So
I think it'd be something to really consider, especially for the format itself.
Yeah, I mean, the guys were mentioning, you know, but Alembic didn't work and so forth. But I think this is a different.
But Alembic is not the same thing.
Exactly.
In fact,
I think this is a different level because they're putting that again in the context of visualization.
Well, listen, I'll just put it this way.
You use USD
to load an Alembic file because USD is a wrapper.
Well, exactly. Yeah. No, we're super excited. I mean, I'm having continuous discussions, it's one of those things that we're gonna grapple with. We're gonna find a way of how to make it unique. You know, and it might be one of those little heaven sent things of going, guys. I've been spending the last 10 years trying to understand how A talks to B, you know, and we are still coming up with new solutions. We have a new plugin that works. You know,
right.
Just write it to USD.
Yeah.
Be done with it.
Right.
You know? And pick your application.
Sure.
I'll send you a USD file.
Right.
And wouldn't that be lovely? Wouldn't it be great? I swear, it's like, because you know, then we're not constrained about we have to use application B.
Right.
You know, which is not really what we want to do because we want to develop a building, like you said earlier, that doesn't look like application B.
You know?
We want to have a little flavor there, right?
Yeah.
We want to throw things in there. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, cool, Cobus. This has been, we're over an hour, which is great. And I don't want to take too much more of your time.
No, great.
But this has been a fabulous conversation.
Great, awesome.
And you know, well, I think we should start us fine in maybe another year or so.
Sure.
We'll do it and see like what's changed in the year because it's happening so fast.
Absolutely.
That it'll be great to go back and listen. So remember we were talking about this? We'll think about this change. You know,
I forgot about it because it never happened. Oh, by the way, we're doing this.
Yes. Yeah. Or ray tracing, like how much that's changed, and file formats and everything.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll do it in virtual space next year.
Okay, we'll see. That sounds great.
I always like face to face. Don't worry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, great.
Well, thank you so much, Cobus.
Thanks, Chris. Very much appreciate it.